Hi, this is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeras, New Mexico. And this is our podcast, Host Nation Hospitality. This is a new podcast for us, and it's going to cover things like life overseas, travel, food, books, anything related to living, vacationing, or being overseas. And my first guest on this new podcast is Karen Tram. She's a former DoDEA teacher who has lived in many places and has contributed to several of our anthologies, has just released her own book about teaching during the pandemic. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here, and it's quite an honor to be the first guest. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, it's going to be fun. So first, I'd like to congratulate you on your new book, 100 Days Smart. I read it, and it's just perfect for our Host Nation Hospitality podcast because it reads somewhat like a inspirational book, something educational, a little bit of travel, a little bit of memoir. It's like a smorgasbord of reading. So we'll get to that in a minute, but let's tell our listeners a little bit about your DoDEA career.
So I first started teaching in Guam, and that was prior to it being DoDEA, but it's an important link in how I got there. While I was teaching in Guam, I met a woman who was a counselor at our elementary school, and she told me about DODS, and that day it was DODS, and she said, oh my goodness, you would be a perfect fit for this program. I had never heard of it. So I got the old Apple book. I don't know if anybody listening remembers the application. It used to be a little book with an apple on the front because you had to fill it out by hand and mail it in. But when I left Guam, I filled in the Apple book and I never heard anything back from them. I went back to the States to go to graduate school for a year. And while I was in graduate school, I applied again and got a phone call for an interview, which I went to, and 2 days later, someone called me and said, they offered me a job in the Philippines, and they said, you have 2 days to decide, so let us know. And I was just finishing my program, so I said, okay. So I didn't even stay for the graduation ceremony. I got on the plane, I flew right out to Subic Bay, and I was there for 2 years and really loved it. It was a big adventure. I'd lived in Guam before in the tropics, and I grew up in Florida. So it was, the weather was great, and I loved, you know, I was young and single, fun times. As a matter of fact, that's where I met Gene, my husband. We didn't get married right away from there, but that's where I met him. He left there and went to Somalia, and then he was in the Navy, went to Somalia, and then went to Naples, Italy, and I got a transfer to Germany, and I worked at Strulendorf Elementary School in Bamberg, and that's when we got married. He was still in Naples, so after that first year, I moved down to Naples, or after that one year in Germany, I moved down to Naples, and we were there for 2 years. I taught kindergarten down there. And then we got to go back to Guam, which was very exciting for me because I'd lived there before and I had a lot of friends there. It was still non-DoDEA schools at that time, but I got a job there because they really needed teachers. And I taught there for 3 years. We went back to the States. Gene went to Navy postgraduate school in Monterey. That's where we had our kids, 2 boys. Uh-huh. And then we went to Iceland, and in Iceland, the school there offered me a job, but I wanted to be home with my boys. And so I had taken all my teaching things and put them in storage so I wouldn't be tempted, because I missed teaching, but I knew that that would come back. And I knew that time with my kids would never come back. So I stayed connected with the school. I took classes through them, and I started a travel photo business. I wrote travel articles for the newspaper there and went back to school and got another graduate degree. So I stayed busy. We went to Virginia after that, and I was a full-time mom while we were there. And then when we moved to Spain after that, Gene was stationed on the at the weather center there. And I went back to school as a sub first, when my kids were both old enough to be in school. I went back as a sub, as a local hire. I got hired to teach kindergarten half time. So I taught with a team taught with another teacher, Marilyn Kopel. She was a good friend. And I taught the morning part of the day, and she taught the afternoon. The kids were there all day. And that was a great year. And then the next 2 years, I was there full time. And then in order to get all my benefits back, I had to move. So I called Gene one day and I said, hey, you ready to retire? And he was not there. He was in France, actually, that day, skiing with a friend. They were actually moving him. And it's probably a good thing we had to do this on the phone. Who would have thought more if we hadn't? But I said, what do you think about moving to Italy? And he was like, oh, okay. So we did it. And I excessed myself and we moved to Vicenza. I moved with the kids first because he had to finish his time up in Rota. So I took the boys and we went to Vicenza and I started working there. And my oldest was in sixth grade. My youngest was in fourth. And Gene came along a few months later after he was disentangled from the Navy. And we were there for 16 years. Mm-hmm. I never expected to be there that long, but we loved it there. And I wanted my kids to have some stability while they were in high school. And they both graduated from Vicenza High School. And yeah, 16 years came and went in a blink of an eye.
Wow. So now I have two follow-up questions. I had one follow-up. Now I have two. So what were you doing in Guam in the first place?
So when I graduated from college the first time with my bachelor's degree, education degree, it was hard to get a job. And I had a friend whose dad was in the Navy. She graduated the year before I did. And she had a degree in social work. And she went out there and she got a job as a high school guidance counselor. And she started writing to me going, you really need to come out here because they need teachers really bad. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, I don't know. That's really far away. I've never really traveled like that before. Mm-hmm. But I decided to go. And so I borrowed $500 from my mom. I got a one-way ticket and I went out there without a job. But when I got there, I had a friend and she took me right downtown to the Department of Education. And they said, oh, I did send an application ahead of time in the mail. I will say that. Mm-hmm. Never heard back from them. But they said, oh, we've been waiting for you. Do you want this job down in Marizzo? And it was just at the very southern part of the island. And my girlfriend said, no, that's too far. Tell them, no, you don't want that job. I said, want me to tell them I don't want this job? She goes, yeah, they'll give you another one. And they did. So anyway, so that's how I ended up there for 2 years. And to me, that was the big adventure. I mean, it just seemed like, you know, now I look at Guam and that's so safe. They speak English, they use dollars, it's American system. But for me, it was so hard for me to wrap my head around the fact that this was a place outside of America. I'd never really done that before. So that was my first jumping off point, and that just hooked me. I was done after that. I had the travel bug.
Wow. Well, so you rattled off an entire list of all these places you've been assigned. So of all the places you've been assigned, which was your favorite and why? And which did you like the least? Although I guess for a segment on life overseas and travel and culture, et cetera, we don't maybe want to have a least favorite. So
Cersei, people probably ask this to you too, because you've lived in quite a few places and that's really hard. So my answer for that is my favorite is always where I'm at. It has to be that way. So I have favorite things about every place, but my favorite is always where I'm at. For example, in Subic, I was so excited. I was young. I was overseas. I met my husband there. When I was in Germany, I loved my school. We worked in a old army hospital, a German army hospital, and the kindergarten rooms were the contagious disease ward out in the woods. So when my kids got off the bus, we got to walk down this little gravel driveway to this log cabin in the woods. And that's where my room was. So I love that. I felt like Hansel and Gretel every day going out to the little log cabin in the woods. Anyway, so there was that. And then Naples, well, if you've ever been to Naples, yeah, that's just such a vibrant place. And that was before I had kids and we could really go out and enjoy a lot of that life and food. And that hooked me on Italy, I have to say it, because I loved living in Naples. I know some people hate it, but I think, you know, you have to love where you live.
Yeah.
I loved Rota. I loved Spain. That was beautiful. Our school there was a very close knit. Mm-hmm. And of course, I love Vicenza. I was there 16 years and I have so many good close friends that are still there. We traveled a lot from there. And of course, the food and the wine, we love that a lot, which of course, that's kind of a problem when you love that too much. So it's hard to say what my favorite is. It's where I'm at. So right now I have to say it's Florida because that's where I'm at.
That's good. I mean, there are people who literally get sent overseas and they endure their entire tour. And that's so sad.
Right.
So why did you choose to become a teacher in the first place? And then the second question, the follow-up to that is, how has teaching changed since you first started teaching? You know, you just retired last year, so this is all very fresh.
I did. It's been less than a year since I retired. So, well, my grandmother was a teacher, and I think that probably was something, but I don't know. I just felt it called to me. I just felt like that was something I wanted to do. So that I went right in. I never did change my major. It was always education. And, you know, for my 4-year degree after that, I jumped right into teaching and I did it in Guam. And the thing about continuing that, I know a lot of teachers get in and get out, but for me, it was such a big adventure. And working for Judea just gave me so many opportunities, not only to see different parts of the world and meet fascinating people and work with these fabulous families. They also gave us a lot of latitude in what we taught. And, you know, we had a curriculum guide, but back in the day, I think they were, a lot of times they're kind of scared of kindergarten, you know, these little guys. They would say, okay, this is what we want you to teach, but you go ahead and approach that in your own way. And I love that because I just felt like I was really creative and I was allowed to integrate and make connections. And I think these days, education is moving in a different direction where they want everybody on the same page doing the same thing. And that's really hard for little ones because they come in and they're all on a different page. You know, we have kids that have been in preschool. We have kids that have been in Sure Start in Judea. We have kids that were in the Italian preschool or home daycare or no daycare. I mean, they're all over the place. They're all on their own page and they leave on their own page, which is okay. And I tell parents, as long as they're turning the pages, it's all good. You know, that's what I felt like. And my job, I felt like, was to teach kids to love school because I'm the beginning. You know, I'm the start. And that's the very most important thing. And if your kids come home and you say, well, what'd you do today? And they say, well, we played. Well, that's the plan. You know, play and learning are not mutually exclusive. That's how we do it right in early childhood. So that's where I think things are changing a lot. A lot of academic things are being pushed down on kids when I'm not sure they're quite ready for them. You know, we're, for example, trying to give writing assessments to kindergartners who can't even hold a pencil, those kind of things. That's where I see, you know, education changing in a way that I'm not comfortable with. So it was a good time for me to retire anyway. So I didn't have to feel bad about that. I loved my kids and I love my job and I love the opportunities that Judea gave me. So awesome. It's been a good ride the whole way.
Awesome. Well, so let's talk about your book. In 100 Days Smart, you talk about technology. And I imagine that's another thing that has changed a lot in your career.
Very much.
You talk about technology and how that really played into how you were able to develop and continue teaching during the pandemic. So were you tech savvy before the pandemic, or did you have to learn like so many other people in order to pull it off?
Okay, so I'm going to just admit right up front, I was not tech savvy, that I knew how to write a parent newsletter and I did it every Friday and I wrote it in Word and I was so proud that I knew how to make it into a PDF. And that's about it for me. So when this happened, we had just started to explore technology components of our curricular materials. And I was familiar with them, but I didn't use them consistently. And Cersei, this is why I get back to the fact that when my kids are in my class, they deserve my face and they deserve me and they deserve interaction. And sometimes putting kids on a computer, especially kids that aren't comfortable communicating, I feel like it's a disservice to them. They need to be interacting. They need to be talking with me and not being talked at. So I shied away from using a lot of computer programs that involve the kids one-on-one. If there were things they could use on our big smart board and we could stand up and talk to them and be part of a group, that's a different thing.
So
I was familiar with some, but not all. But I have to say, oh my goodness, my aide in the book, it's Miss D, but her name is Miss Darnell. She was like a miracle worker. She would just look at me and she could probably see on my face that I did not know what was going on. And she's going, I got it. She would get stuff before I even knew I had a problem, you know, and that's the glory of working with someone for the, it's not the first year, you know, and I've worked with a lot of different educational aides. All of them have been fabulous. the first year you're getting to know each other and knowing the routine, and the second year it's like butter. You're just on, you just know what each other are thinking. And I loved that about her, is that she knew I had a problem before I knew I had a problem, and she was on it. And I could just see her when we were, especially when we're Zooming with the kids, she's going, I got this. Don't worry. I know how to do this. And she was great. She was my savior. Her, and then also my husband's pretty tech savvy too. And now I rely on him a little bit, and my boys, my kids, because yeah. They are too. But, you know, I had to text my son Ian the other day and ask him where to find a downloaded book on my phone. And I said, you are not allowed to make a YouTube video about your mom who does not know where to find stuff on her phone. Yeah. So he just laughed because I've seen that.
Yeah. Yeah. You need to actually make him sign an agreement or something.
That's right. It's true.
In writing. So it is said that DoDEA students consistently score higher than other school districts across the board. And there's always scientific reasons and things like that given. But why do you personally think DoDEA students score so high?
Well, I'd like to say it's the teachers. I think we do have a special group of teachers that are like challenges and that are flexible, because those are the kind of people that are attracted to go overseas and have this kind of work. So I think that is a component of it. But honestly, I think the big picture is that all of our students have an employed parent. Yeah. All of our students have health care. Mm. None of our students live in their car. You know, we have huge community support within a military community. We have MWR, we have the Skies, we have art centers, we have youth sports, we have trips for the kids. Mm. The libraries are rich with resources and materials. And I think that they just really are able to have a very rich community and environment when they take advantage of that. And I think a lot of families do. And this is not to say that we don't have challenges. I mean, you know, because right. we've lived this life, we have deployments, we have many moves, but out of that comes the ability to adapt. It becomes acceptance of other kids and their differences, the resilience to all of those changes. I have never seen more accepting communities of other kids than DoDEA schools. I mean, just right. it is just everybody's there. And my kids went to those schools. So I'm speaking both as a teacher and as a parent.
Right. I
really couldn't have wished for anything more for my kids.
Well, and that's a constant thing that the brats say, you know, that's what they say. You know, we got along, we made friends quickly, you know, we were there for each other. And many of our listeners, of course, have grown up in the Dodd school system, you know, now the DoDEA school system, and they have memories of their childhood and their teachers and the unique situations they were exposed to, you know, and I think the more exposure you have to different cultures and to different, you know, even different curriculum, it makes a huge difference in your growing up and your, you know, your well-roundedness, if that's a word. So
absolutely.
So going back to another book that you participated in, Schooling with Uncle Sam, that was our first book that you sent in a story for. You had a very interesting playground visitor when you were stationed. Well, let me let you tell it.
Okay. So yeah, actually this is a two-part story because my kids came in. Well, the school that I was at was in the Philippines, Calayan Elementary School. It was right on the edge of the jungle, like everything was there. And my kids came in from recess one day. I was teaching first grade. And they said, teacher, there's a cobra on the slide. And I'm like, what? And they said, yeah, there was a cobra on the slide. And the man came with a stick and took it off. And I'm like, oh, okay. So, you know, the gardeners, we had a lot of gardeners there. The grounds were really beautiful and the gardeners were there. They had these snake sticks, these long wooden poles with hooks on the end that they would deal with the snakes with. So I saw one of the gardeners outside my classroom a little bit later and asked him, and he goes, also I forgot to say this. I asked the kids what it looked like. And they said, oh, it looked like Jacob's pants. And I looked at my little student Jacob and he had cami pants on, and I'm like, okay. So then I asked the gardener, what was it? And he said, oh, it was just a little python, don't worry about it. And I'm like, okay, well, at least it wasn't a cobra. So then a few, I don't know how much later this happened, but I know for a fact it was in November, because I remember this next part of the story happened during American Education Week, which was in November, and they had invited parents into the schools. And I was teaching reading, and I was in the front of the room talking with the kids, having a little lesson, and my aide's in the back of the classroom, and she's mouthing words to me, and I'm looking at her, and she's going, "There's a snake back here." And I'm like, "Oh, God, I hate snakes. I'm just saying, I hate them." So I got the kids to get up, and we walked around the school for a little bit, and then we had our host nation class. So I took them down there, and I came back, and she had gotten all the backpacks out of the room, and the gardeners were in there with their snake stick. So they take it out, and I had kind of, you know, backed up. I was on my desk at that point when I had a parent walk in his khakis and wondered why I was on my desk. And I just said, "Well, they just took a snake out of my classroom." And then he made a joke, and he asked me if I had alcohol in my desk, if I was drinking it, or if I needed it. And I thought, well, probably need it right now. But I, you know, of course, that was just a joke. But anyway, later, the assistant principal came into my room, Jim Bowers, and he said, we need to tell you that the snake they took out was a young cobra, and they mate for life, and there could be another one in here, so you need to be careful." And I'm like, "Are you serious?" So we never found one that day, but a few months later, they found another snake in our little pod. I don't know if it was a cobra. I don't know if it was the mate. They took it out. But, we don't know how long it had been in there or anything like that.
Wow.
So that's the story.
So I was going to ask you if finding a snake in the playground was common, but I guess it was. So what did that do for your playground duty? How did that affect you?
I did not have playground duty, and that's probably a good thing, because it never would have ended well if I was out there with the snake on the playground. But the gardeners were, there was a lot of noise when the kids were out there. So the snakes would stay away from that for the most part. I guess first class out might take a, you know, might surprise any snakes. That's probably what happened with the python on the slide. But the gardeners were out there with the snake sticks. So that they were always present on the grounds, and the aides were out on the playground with the kids. So that was the solution. And I can't really even remember it happening any other time other than that. But that happened.
Wow. So other than snakes, what was it like living in the Philippines? What are some of the great things you did or things you ate that you never could have imagined doing, but now it's like, "Oh yeah, I love it," or "I've done that"?
Well, I did love scuba diving. And I learned to scuba dive when I was in Guam the first time, but I dove a lot when I was in the Philippines, and I loved that. As far as food, my favorite thing that I learned to eat, well, that I got to eat when I was there, was mangoes, because we used to have a big mango tree in our backyard in Florida, and my dad had to chop it down because my sister turned out to be allergic to mangoes. So we couldn't have the mango tree in the yard. I've never really had them. I'll never forget the first time I tried mangoes, and we were at some little hotel somewhere, and we were eating breakfast, and they took those mangoes and cut them open and scored them and flipped them inside out, and it was the best thing. Oh my gosh, it was so good. And then they made mango juice out of it, and it was really thick and delicious and icy. Then the very best thing of all was the mango ice cream, the Magnolia mango ice cream. It was so good. They used to have a little kiosk at the airport where they would sell the mango ice cream. And even after I didn't live there anymore, when we went back to Guam, when I was there the second time, and when we were traveling, we have a layover in Manila, I'd say, "Oh, I got to go in and get some ice cream." So I'd run in and I'd find the mango ice cream kiosk, and I would always have mango ice cream, even if it was just the layover. So my
mangoes,
that and the other thing that they did there that was very interesting is sometimes in some restaurants you could go to, they would serve the food on a banana leaf. And I always thought that was kind of cool too, to eat with your hands, and you would eat your food off the banana leaf. And it wasn't all restaurants, but there were some that did that. And I just loved it because it was just so different.
Yeah, no, it sounds awesome. So Host Nation Hospitality is our second book, and you wrote up a follow-up piece to the schooling about your house in Italy. You wrote a piece that described your house, which made me just want to move in with you. You know, I was just going to come over there. can come over there and live with you. And then you told me you were leaving, you were moving. And I was like, why would you ever leave that house? So I wanted you kind of to tell us about your house and its name and just a little bit about life in that part of Italy.
So the house was in Vicenza, which is about 30 miles outside of Venice. And when I transferred from Rota, Jean and I took the boys over to Vicenza right when school was out to look for a house. And we found something and we went back to Rota. We packed up the house and drove all the way to Vicenza. That's another story.
That's a long drive.
It was a drive. We took a car ferry for part of it. It was fun. We broke it up. We had a good time, but we had some adventures along the way. Anyway, we got there and checked into the hotel and checked out the house. And the guy said, you know what, this is not really going to work out. So I had to start looking for a house again. So Jean was there for a couple of weeks. We found another house. The owner was going to do some updates to it and wanted me to move in the beginning of October. So I said, okay, fine. So the boys and I were in the hotel. Jean had to go back to Rota. And then the owner, he loved his update so much, he decided to sell his house. So we were back to looking again. And I'm at work. And so I'm trying to squeeze this in on the weekend or after school and figuring out, am I bringing the boys or they have sports practice. I mean, when it's just one person, you know, it's hard.
Yeah.
So I was at my wit's end and I finally found this one place. You could go to the housing office and get on the computer. I found this one place. It was at the very end of the list and there was no pictures, which was probably a red flag right there. But I went out to it and I kept thinking, gosh, you know, this place, it was kind of run down and the yard was a mud pit and it was all out in the country. And I was just thinking about my kids and how much it would be so good. It would be so good for them to have some space because they're loud. They're boys, you know, they were 11 and 12 years old. I was like, gosh, this would be a good place. There was animals that I didn't have to take care of because the landlord did that. There was a garden out there that I didn't have to take care of because the landlord did that. So I called Gene on the phone and I was talking to him. He goes, oh, it sounds like you can take this place. I said, it does. He goes, yeah, I think so. And then that was it. I just gave up and I said, okay. So I took this place and it sure did need a lot of work. Gene, when he looked at it, I'm glad I wasn't with him. He actually went out there by himself because I was still at school and he saw it for the first time. So when I got home, when he was building beds and I was putting away stuff in the kitchen, I didn't even want to look at it. But anyway, so we moved into the house and we ended up putting air conditioning in. We put ceiling fans in. We planted grass in the yard and little by little, we fixed it up and we just really came to love it. We put we ordered a hot tub from the Navy Exchange catalog and we put it on the side of the house and it just turned a house into a home. And it was a place we really loved to come home to. And I think that's important anywhere you live. Even if you're just going to be there for a little while, you want to be happy to come home back. And it was. And so we did give our house a special name. We called it the Agriturismo Bolzano Vicentino. And Agriturismo is a like a little farm place, a farm B&B. And we had stayed at a lot of them. And they're just sweet little country places where you go and eat with the families and they have animals and plants and gardens, kind of like our house. So we just named it that. Bolzano Vicentino was the town where our house, the little community where our house was. So we called it the Agriturismo Bolzano Vicentino, and that name just kind of stuck. The ABV, we called it. So.
Well, and then the pandemic hit. So how did that affect your beautiful little B&B type existence out there in a little community with wine and pizza?
So life did change. We, in the beginning, you know, we didn't know COVID happened in Italy, very close to where we lived. Just, I don't want to say down the street, but 30 minutes away was the first death. And when it happened and the schools closed, we didn't have any notice. You know, I put my kids on the bus and said, see you Monday. And I never saw them again face to face. So it was a surprise. We went back to school. Well, the first couple of days we didn't. We just were kind of on this weird wait and see what happens. And we just thought on Wednesday, everybody's going to come back to school. That never happened. So we went back and we worked out of our classrooms, empty classrooms in the beginning. And but then when we were sent home to work, I have to say, you know, living out in the country away from everything was a blessing, because we could walk out there, exercise. You're only allowed to walk 200 meters from your house. And that was really to walk your dog. But we were out in the country and no one was around. So we walked up and down the driveway. I exercised more then during the pandemic than I did regularly, because, you know, it was right there and we could get out and do that. And we felt safe out there. We didn't feel like, I know that I have a lot of friends that were in apartment buildings and they were really locked in. I mean, they just had this very small space. And for us, you know, we still had the garden and we could walk, and it was a good place to be. And being out in the country like that, it was really quiet. And we started seeing animals come out. We saw deer in our front yard. We saw the big giant hares with the big ears, all kinds of birds, things that we hadn't really paid attention to that much before, when you're in your busy life and you're leaving to go to school when it's dark and you get home and it's dark. And all of a sudden we were there and we watched the flowers bloom and the corn come up, and it was a good part of what happened. You know, there was a lot of challenging things about what happened, but having that house was a blessing.
Wow.
I would say. Yeah.
So that brings us to the book, 100 Days Smart. And so this book is going to resonate with our listeners on so many levels. First of all, we all experienced the pandemic, and many of our listeners grew up in Italy or were overseas or were teachers. And, you know, a lot of us parents know about the first 100 days of school and its significance to kids. So there's a lot in your book that will appeal to different people. So what compelled you to write a book about teaching kindergartners during the pandemic?
Well, you know, it was strange, because I just woke up one morning and there were so many things in my head. And I said to Jean, I said, could you just bring me a legal pad? Because I need to make some notes. I need to write some things down. Sometimes I just wake up and I feel like I need to write. And it was that day. He brought me a legal pad and I just started writing down dates and notes, because we were going through this situation that was unbelievable. Every single day brought something else that was so unbelievable that I thought, is this really happening? And I kept thinking back to when I was a kid. I loved to read, and I used to read stories by Laura Ingalls Wilder about her adventures living out on the prairie and whatnot. And I kept thinking, thank goodness she wrote that down so people would know what happened. And her stories weren't all just cheerful. I mean, they had some extreme challenges as well. Right. And I thought, no one is ever going to know what happened here with these kids and this school and Americans that are in this situation right at the very pinpoint of what happened, where it started in Italy, unless someone writes it down. So I just started making notes, and I just was doing little journal entries every day, just important things that were happening or weird things that were happening, because weird things did happen. So I just started jotting notes down, and then it grew. And then it was very therapeutic for me as well, because things were going quickly with us, and I knew that was going to happen in the States, and I was anxious and upset, and, you know, writing is just such a good way to deal with that. So, you know, it was selfishly, part was for me to give me a little closure and help me process what was going on, but also the fact that the people that were there knew what was going on, but really nobody else knew what it was like for the kids in that school. So that's really why I did it.
Well, I think it's cool. And, you know, in your book, you include emails and memos and personal experiences. And so now that I know that during the pandemic, you were already taking notes and you were documenting history, that is pretty cool, because I did the same thing. Many of our listeners are writers, and they're listening to hear your process. They want to know what your process was. You know, how did you handle the names of parents, teachers, colleagues, you know, children in a nonfiction book? Because that's a question we all have to deal with as writers.
And that was something I had to learn. So for my colleagues, I talked to them about it. If I wanted to use their stories or their emails or their messages to me, I showed them exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. I cut and pasted it. And I said, look, I'm working on a writing project. And I told them what it was about. I'd like to include some of our conversation. This is what it says. Is it okay with you? And so then they, you know, wrote back and they said, yes, it's fine. And then once I got involved with Elvarisa, there was another additional step of having them sign a release for that. But right from the get-go, right up front, I said, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, are you okay with this? And I didn't have anybody tell me no. For parents and students, what I did is I, of course, changed the names and changed the sexes, the genders of the kids. Mm-hmm. So no one's really recognizable. And a lot of the conversation with parents and the emails with parents, it was a tidal wave in the beginning when we were trying to get it together. So a lot of the emails overlapped with subjects. So I would take them and kind of combine them and write one email that reflected everybody's concern at that time. So it wasn't redundant and it wasn't identifiable. So that's kind of how I got through that.
That's cool. Did you have to get permission from DoDEA to write the book?
I did not. And I actually went to the union and asked about that. And they said, as long as you don't write anything disparaging about DoDEA, then, you know, it's not a problem. And I don't think I wrote anything disparaging about DoDEA. I hope I portrayed it in a positive light because we scrambled. The teachers really did hit the ground running. And I hope that comes off in a positive way.
It did. It absolutely did. So once you finished the book, how did you market it to Elvarisa or to a publisher? Did you start off thinking Elvarisa right off the bat, or did you just sort of throw it out there to the wind?
Well, I had never heard of Elvarisa. What I did is I started looking at books I was reading and just looking at different publishers and checking them out online. And I wish now I remember the book. I don't know what it was because I trade books with my friends all the time, but I had a book and the publisher was Elvarisa. So when I checked out Elvarisa, I thought, oh, for and about military families, maybe this is a good one. So they were the first ones that I sent to. And as I, well, at, when I first looked, they weren't accepting any manuscripts at that time. And when they opened it up and they had a call for stories, I said, okay. And I went on their website and I pulled the application up and I started looking at it. And I was like, book proposal, what is that? You know, there's all these things you have to do that I had no idea what it was. And I was still teaching and trying to do this on the side or after midnight. So I tried to get my ducks in a row for that. And when they finally opened for stories and I filled out the form, I got to this one field that said, what is your platform? And they want a website. I'm like, oh, I don't have a website. I don't know. You know, I don't have any of that. So I tried to circumvent it because, you know, sometimes you can put a period in there and it'll just let you go. Yeah. Or sometimes you can put a space in there or whatever. And I couldn't get past it. So I thought, okay, I'm going to build a website. I thought I can do this like in a day. That was such a joke. So I tried to build a website. Now I actually went online and went to WordPress and started doing it, but it was last week of school and I couldn't get it right. And I just thought, okay, I need to leave this alone because school was out and we had a trip planned. And then I was going back to the States to see family and I just had to let that go. So I didn't want to leave the story go though. I just was compelled. I just felt like it was something I had to do. It was just like that day in the bed when I woke up and had to write. I just had to finish this. So I got to that part of the application and I put Elvarisa's website in it. And I just thought, well, it'll just get me past that field, you know, and it did.
Right.
And they never said anything about that. I don't know if they noticed it or not, but when I put it in, I thought, well, that's going to be sink or swim. They're going to look at that and go, no. Or they're going to look at that and go, hey, you know, she just really wants this to work. And so I hope that's what they thought. But
wow, I'm going to have to try that next time I'm in some sort of some sort of death loop about putting things in. So when does the book come out?
So the book is coming out on February 21st. So coming soon. That's on Tuesday. So I'm really excited about it because this is besides your two anthologies, this is my only book that's all just me. So
good. Hey, breaking news. We're scooping that the book is coming out. Yeah. So the 21st, that's Mardi Gras.
Is it really? That's a perfect date. Well, the
I think so.
The other reason that that date is significant is that that was the 100th day of school. That was the day that I put my kids on the bus and said, see you Monday, and never saw them again. That was February 21st. And so that's significant to me now in more than one way. It was, that was the beginning.
Foreshadowing. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I know. It's just like it was all meant to be. It all just is coming together.
Well, cool. Well, I'll put the link to Alvarisa on the bottom of our link for our podcast. So I want to change a little gear. So you moved from Italy to Florida right before that humongous hurricane last year. How'd you survive? Well, how'd you do in that? And then had you ever been any sort of natural disaster of that magnitude before?
Yeah, I'm going to have to really, I have so many stories I could tell you, but that's a different book. But what I am going to say is that we had just put a bid in on the house. It had just been accepted for our home. It's not a new house. We bought it from someone, and the storm came but we had not signed anything. We had not closed on the house. The house was fine. It was okay. And we were really grateful for that. I was still staying with my parents, and we were afraid for their house because they're right on the water. And we went to their house and we just put everything up and closed that house up and went and stayed at my sister's house and crossed our fingers and hoped for the best. Mm-hmm. It was weird to walk away from that house and think I might not see it again, because that was a house I grew up in, but it was fine. That was all good. But then we came back, we closed on our house. And just a few days later, we had another hurricane, Nicole, that came through, and we have sliding glass doors in the back. So Jean we have this Kevlar material that we put up over the glass. Mm-hmm. Well, he had to fly to LA to go deal with some family business. So he put the Kevlar up and left. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is just like when I was a Navy wife, because that same thing happened in Virginia Beach. When we moved there, we moved in the house. I was there a week. He left and a hurricane came. And I was like, this is such deja vu, but now in my retired world. So yes, he was a meteorologist in the Navy. So we lived in weather places. So when we were in Guam, we had major typhoons. The other thing that happened when we were in Guam, we had a huge earthquake. It was an 8.2. That's a gigantic earthquake. And it was 56 seconds or something like that. So we'd had a little taste of natural disasters before. And I have to say that the hurricanes that happened here were absolutely awful for the people down in Fort Myers and in Sanibel. Yeah. That was terrible. We were lucky. That's what I'm going to say. We were lucky.
Yeah. Wow. So you completed the book while you were in Florida then, or did you finish it all?
No, actually, I finished it in Italy. I worked on it that first summer in 2020. We were out in February 2020, virtual school for the rest of the school year. And I had been working on it during that time, trying to, just tie things together. Mm-hmm. And then I worked on it a little bit over the summer. And then that's the summer. No, it was and then I continued the next school year working on it, because it was the summer after. I'm trying to remember all this in my head. It was the summer before I retired that I turned it into Alvarisa, that I applied to Alvarisa, or whatever you would say. But it was all done in Italy, but I actually submitted it while I was in Florida, because I was home on vacation. I had my computer on my mom's sewing machine cabinet, and I pulled her in the room, and it was the very last day to submit. It was the day that I put Elvarisa's website in that field. And I said, Mom, watch, I'm going to do this. And I hit submit, and that was it. And then I didn't hear from, I heard from Elvarisa in September. So that was July 31st. So I heard from them in September.
Yeah. Well, very, very cool. Because of this podcast, Host Nation Hospitality is about Host Nation and all the cool stuff we get to experience by traveling, I'm going to ask you to free associate on a couple of things. Ready?
Yes.
Okay. The most photographic event you've ever attended overseas.
Okay. So that would have to be Carnevale in Venice.
Yeah, imagine.
Venice has such a gorgeous backdrop to start with. And you put those Carnival costumes in the front, and it's just stunning. It's beautiful. there's a lot of different carnivalic celebrations that we've been to in Italy and in France and in Spain too. And all of them have their beauty. In Spain, oh my gosh, the feria with the horses and the beautiful dresses. There's so many different beautiful, beautiful things that we've seen. But I think Venice has to be the one that is the most photogenic. It's gorgeous.
Okay, next question. Favorite museum?
Oh, that one's hard. I love all of the, I'm an art lover, so art museums are my favorite. I'm going to say that. And I have my big six, and I'm not going to run through all those because there's something good about every one, just like the places you live. There's something good about every one. But I think probably my favorite off the top of my head would be the National Gallery in London, because it's big and it's free. And London, if you're walking around London and it starts raining, you can run inside that museum and you can just look at a part of it. And because it's free, you don't feel like you have to go in the entire thing. And then you come out and you can enjoy London some more. And then the next day when it rains again, because that's what it does in London, you run back over there and you go through another part of it. So I think it would be that one. And it's big and it's got a lot of good stuff in it. I love it. I love that museum. But I love the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, and I love the Louvre, and I love the Prado in Madrid, and the Uffizi, and the Vatican Museum. So that's really hard, but I would say National Gallery in London.
Okay. Okay. This one might be easier. Most unique method of travel you've taken?
So a couple of years ago, Jean and I took a trip it was a train trip over the glacier in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And that was very cool because it was eight different trains. We got on in Vicenza and we took a train to Milan and then up to, was it Lugano? I can't remember. And then we got on one called the Bernina Express that went up over part of the Alps. And then we spent the night somewhere in Switzerland and we got on the Glacier Express. And these trains are glass top. So when you're riding, it's just like being outside. And even though it was April, when you get up there in the mountains, there's still a lot of snow up there. And there were people that were hang gliding up there or kite sailing. I don't know what they were doing. It was like a bunch of butterflies. We came around the corner and there's all these colorful kites in the air with people on them. And it was an amazing trip. So I think it would be that. Although that's another hard one. We've done some interesting things. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say you're our most enthusiastic person we've had on this podcast, but you are the first. So.
Okay. Well,
all right. So most interesting food you've tried?
That would be snake in Hong Kong. Uh-huh. And you know, I had a dream one time. I am not a fan of snakes, as I've said before. And I had a dream one time that if I ate snake, that I would no longer be afraid of snakes. So when I went to Hong Kong, and this is when I was living in the Philippines, went to Hong Kong, I thought, okay, let's see if that's going to be a dream come true. So I ordered snake at a restaurant, and it was in this mix of vegetables, and it was kind of like a mushroomy taste. I don't know. And I didn't hate it. I probably wouldn't order it again. But the bottom line, it did not cure my fear of snakes. Because, you know, for me, you read the book, so you know that my stress dreams, sometimes I have snakes in them. I dream about snakes when I'm stressed. And yeah, that still happens. Although since I retired, I don't think I've had a snake dream. So that's good.
Well, there are lots of snakes in Florida. So just beware.
I know. Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you were going to advise a friend who is spending 4 days in your part of Italy, what are some things they should do and where should they eat?
So we were in Northern Italy near Venice. So Venice is a must do, mm-hmm. even if it's just for one day. And now sometimes it's so very crowded, but you still have to go to Venice. It's really nice at night when the tourists leave. You could spend the night in Venice. That's an awesome thing. And Venice is just, and get lost in Venice. Don't try to use a map. Just get lost in Venice, because you can always find your way back to the train station or the bridges, because there's signs on the buildings, and it, everywhere you go is beautiful, even the little tiny alleys. So I would say that. Okay. And if you're there in summertime, the opera is held in the arena in Verona. And this is an old Roman amphitheater, like the Colosseum in Rome. They have live opera in it at night, and it is fabulous. Now it starts late, like 9:30 at night. So it's the best time to go is when you're jet lagged, so you can stay up late without being tired. Mm-hmm. But the opera in Verona is fabulous. It was like 30 euro. And of course, those are the cheap seats up top. And you sit on the stones, you have to take a cushion with you. But it's something that is to be experienced.
Isn't Verona where Romeo and Juliet was?
Yes, yeah. Romeo and Juliet's house is there. Yes. So Verona, yes, is a good stop. Also, I would say do a day of wine tasting. Prosecco Hills, Valpolicella for wine tasting. Valdo Biadone is the place to get Prosecco. That's wonderful too. It's beautiful places. There's a place up in the Prosecco Hills near Valdo Biadone where you can actually get Prosecco out of a vending machine. On the side of the road, there's a vending machine. You just get your Prosecco. So I would say that. And then also, if you can, go to the mountains. The Veneto is so, it goes from Venice to Verona, up top, up north, are the Dolomiti Mountains. So Asiago is right there. And that is so beautiful, right? Up there. That's the Asiago cheese is from Asiago. It's right there. If you can go to Bolzano, now that's out of the Veneto. It's about 2 hours away. It's still a day trip from Vicenza. And up there, it's like Germany. They speak German. It's just like a different country up there. Trento, Bolzano, that whole area up there is fascinating. We love to go up there at Christmas time and go to the Christmas markets because they're like the German Christmas markets. I'm sure you're familiar.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you've given me some ideas if I get to Italy. And I'm sure our listeners who've lived in Italy are like, yep, check. So what are your next plans? Are you going to write another? It sounded like you were teasing there was another book happening.
Well, I am working on a project. It's kind of morphed into different things over the past couple of years since COVID, but I was home one summer and my dad said, Karen, look what I have. And he brought this shoebox out to me and he had some letters that I had written to him when I lived in Guam the first time, when I was a teacher before I was married. He had all of them for 2 years, and it was so interesting because it was all of my thoughts about being overseas in Guam, about being a first-time teacher, because that was my first time teaching, and I was reading these, and it was fascinating for me to go back and have all these memories and remember all this stuff. So my son, Ian, before he went to Thailand to work for the Peace Corps, he was with us in Italy for a month or so, and every night at dinner, we would read one of the letters together, and because he was just leaving. And so in the beginning, we were going to try to do my first 2 years in Guam and his years in Thailand. But things fell apart for him in Thailand when COVID came and he had to leave. So I've kind of changed directions on that. And I still really want to use those first 2 years of letters. And now my thinking is 2 years in, and my last 2 years out, because the last 2 years out after 100 Days Smart, when we went back to school, we were back to school before most of the schools in the States were, because we went back immediately in August 2020, right after that. And that was a different world too, you know, with the kids spread out in the mask and they took our robes. There was a lot of things that happened during that time too. And a lot of my thoughts about leaving Italy and leaving teaching. So I'm thinking something along those lines of the beginning and the end. I'm not sure how I'm going to weave it together.
I don't know either, but that would be fascinating because you can discuss so many things, you know, how you were young and fresh faced and idealistic and, you know, and then the technology and all the things that were going on. And then, you know, that would be good. I will follow up with you later and we'll see.
Okay, good.
We have only like a few, very few seconds left. Is there anything?
I talk too much. Sorry.
Well, no, you're a teacher. It was interesting. I talk a lot too. Is there anything you would like to add that I didn't ask? Is there anything?
Well, one thing that I think is really important is I would like to encourage people to talk about their stories. Mm-hmm. That's what started me with this, is that I felt like I have a story, how big or how small, it doesn't really matter. I notice a lot of people don't really talk about about their situation during the pandemic, unless somebody else brings it up. And when you bring it up, man, the doors, the floodgates open and people have a lot to say. They don't usually say it. I don't know. I think people are uncomfortable because it's still kind of raw, but it doesn't matter how big or small your story is. Everybody's story is valid and real. And I think it helps people to talk about it. I also think it's okay to say, you know what? I kind of liked virtual school. I liked being able to give a presentation in my underwear or whatever, because, you know, there's a lot of other people that say that too. We don't always look at the funny things, because it is still raw and scary in a big way for some people. And I think it's important for us to look for the positive in that too. You know, I think a lot of people are like, oh, you know, working from home is not bad. Now I can continue to do that in some way, maybe not full time, but part time. There were so many different things that changed our lives during COVID that really changed them for the better. And I think that's always important for us to look at too, not just all of the devastating things that happened, because that was real too, right. But also, what did we get out of that? What did we learn? You know, how did we refocus our priorities? I think those are all important things to think about.
I think you're onto something with that. Well, Karen, it's been lovely talking to you. And I wanted to thank you for coming on our podcast and for being our first ever guest on Host Nation Hospitality. I would like to remind our listeners that our podcasts are brought to you by the Museum of the American Military Family and Learning Center. And they are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brat Seal and Military Brats Registry. And I wanted to thank you, Karen, for coming on. Congratulations on your new book. I can hardly wait to see part two of the book in a couple of years, and we'll have you back on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I'm honored to be your first guest, and I look forward to listening to some more of your podcasts.
Well, thank you.